A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, here to stand with you against autonomous technologies, runaway markets, and weaponized media that threaten human cognition, solidarity, and survival. It's time to play together. This is Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, Jason Schmidt.
But it's that collaborating together, I think, that academics and the research community does so well. And again, it does so on a different time frame than capitalism.
Jason looks at the big business of for-profit academic publishing in his new documentary, Paywall, The Business of Scholarship. Should the world's knowledge and research be locked behind closed doors? Jason makes the case for open access on today's Team Human. And yes, you can support Team Human and even get a copy of my upcoming book, Team Human, by subscribing to our show. Just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support. You can also read my columns based on the show's monologues at medium.com/@Rushkoff. I've been working on the audiobook for Team Human, so I may sound a little bit hoarse. I've been using too much of my voice lately. But I've got to talk because we have an election coming up in just a few days. And I want to try to encourage people to use their power at the polls, whatever they may think. I feel like we've internalized some of the way our political system really thinks about us, and it's time for us to stop doing that. I teach Ed Bernays in my propaganda class at Queen's College, and I was just looking at the very first line of his book, Propaganda, and he says, "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society. Those who manipulate this unseen mechanism of society constitute an invisible government, which is the true ruling power of our country." Now, Ed Bernays did not mean this in a sad way. He meant this happily. This is the way things are. And I don't know if I'm ready yet to accept that sad premise that people are just too dumb, too uninformed, and too easily fooled to be entrusted with the vote. Even though most of the political class, at least the ones I've met from both sides of the aisle, seem to think so. I remember, gosh, it was back during George W. Bush's re-election campaign, must have been 2004, I was invited to a fancy lunch with an ancient former Secretary of State and some of his associates. And it was at the height of the Swift boat debacle when then Democratic candidate John Kerry was being accused of lying about his tour of duty in Vietnam. And it was this whole big disinformation campaign. And it was the first one really of the internet era, because it was spreading not just on mainstream TV, but through the beginnings of viral social media. And this former secretary was interested in what I'd have to say about this as the, you know, the guy who came up with media viruses and all that. And I explained that, you know, don't worry, the truth will rise to the surface. And thanks to this informational bias of the net, that this culture, the internet culture, would embrace things more like WTO protests and MoveOn.org than stuff like the Tea Party or Fox News. And this guy, the Secretary of State, said, oh, my friend, when will you be ready to accept that the experiment of democracy has been proven a failure? And I was shocked. I was stunned into silence. It was like hearing Bernays speak directly at me. I felt like Tom Cruise at the end of Eyes Wide Shut, where he didn't know if they were like playing with him or if this was their truth. And I do understand the line of reasoning. It's an old one. It was, you know, the line of reasoning that really began with Walter Lippmann when he got all disillusioned after he'd worked with Woodrow Wilson's Creel Commission to convince America to get involved in World War I. And I think he felt bad about it, a little guilty or something. And he ended up writing this book, Public Opinion, where he argued that the government needs to set up some kind of a council of experts because people are just are too confused, that we're all just following the pictures in our heads, is the way he put it, and we can't really vote intelligently. We need instead to have intelligent, benevolent people figure out how we should vote and then just convince us to support those policies. And this view of democracy has characterized voting and policymaking right from him and Ed Bernays right through guys like Roger Stone and Frank Luntz. So the idea is to put pictures in people's heads, whether they're true or false, that get them to vote in particular ways. You know, and I guess, you know, the politician I'd spoken to, the Secretary of State, you know, he was right in his assessment of the failure of democracy at that moment. Even back then, you know, 2004, Fox News and Rush Limbaugh were more effective at winning adherents through emotionally charged hot-button appeals than Democrats were with logic and facts. That people are just so easily swayed by the craft of storytellers and advertisers that how can we expect them to be able to vote? And I thought, naive little me, I thought this problem was kind of solved when we elected Obama. Because here's this cool clinician making appeals to rationality. I mean, he was nothing if not cool. But when you really want to think about it, Obama was really as much the beneficiary of all the romance that was surrounding his candidacy. You know, even if that wasn't the real sell, that was the story people were responding to. You know, if the Democrats had been true wonks at the time, they would have voted for Hillary Clinton, you know, rather than some young guy with no international experience. So even 8 years of Obama doesn't disprove the possibility that democracy failed. You know, and now, more than ever, the political landscape's characterized less by facts than by nostalgia and attacks and the melodrama that we instinctually respond to. And the pollsters, the policy pushers, they don't give this manipulation a second thought, right? To them, democracy is not the right to be members of an informed electorate. It's rather, it's the right to do whatever is necessary to make that electorate vote the way you want them to. They're just the masses anyway, and the masses are a means to an end. You know, and that's really Orwellian, but it's the predominant way of thinking, not just on the Republican side, not just talking to, you know, Frank Luntz and changing estate tax to death tax or global warming to climate change in order to appeal to people emotionally. When I challenged him about all that, and he said, well, do you want to win? As if that's the whole thing. If you want to win, then you're going to be willing to do whatever is necessary to win. And the left is becoming guilty of this too. I mean, for all the left's talk of going high when they go low, the Democrats, at least the establishment Democrats, are less interested in describing the logic of their own policies than in frightening people about their opponents. Back when Hillary was running against Trump, I tried to get in touch with the Democratic National Council or the various PACs, and I wanted to give them a mimetic analysis of Hillary Clinton because I really believed that they were positioning her wrong and that the policies that they were trying to put forth weren't resonating with voters because of the preconceptions they had about her, and that really needed to be fixed. And nobody was interested in talking with me. They all assumed that Hillary would win. And then, as soon as the election was over, all of a sudden I start hearing from people. There were all these little impromptu sessions at various apartments in New York. I was at one at Eric Schneiderman, the former New York State Attorney General, was at. And, you know, Adbusters people. I was at one with the Yes Men. And at one of them, I met the head of the Center for American Progress, which is, you know, the most Clintonian of the political analysis groups. And that was one of the places that I wanted to pitch my Hillary stuff. And now, finally, they seemed interested in what I had to say. So I was talking about how we have to disseminate a campaign of you know, social good, of teaching communities how to do mutual aid. And don't call it left, don't call it right, but that if people become acquainted with mutual aid and helping their neighbors and even things like local currencies and food banks, that they would become more familiar with really what are leftist policies and then be more favorable to them when elections happen. And she said, oh my gosh, there's no time for that. Can't you just do an analysis of Trump? She wanted to drive up Trump's negatives. Those are her words. And there's a logic to that because she thought that if I could figure out the ways in which Trump was the most vulnerable, then she and her team could go on CNN or MSNBC and highlight all those negative things. You know, and I get that. But this has been the de facto strategy of establishment Democrats right up through this midterm election. And if the blue wave fails to materialize next week, it will be because of this strategic failure. So call me naive, but I believe Americans really do care how their votes will impact the world in real ways. And emphasizing negatives and triggering crowd panic and playing to our outrage or going low, it gives up on real democracy. And it's not even working. You know, every time that the left emphasizes Trump's negatives, it just positions him even more as the protagonist of some national story. You know, he may not be a good person or nice or a good president. He may even be a would-be tyrant with a personality disorder. But he's also, as far as the national story is concerned, what we see on TV, he is a man under constant attack. So eventually, no matter how dastardly a character, whether he's Frank Underwood or Gru or Richard III or Regina George, you know, the audience can't help but empathize with that character's plight when they're on the defense. You know, like him or not, everyone recognizes the humanity in his wriggling and excuse-making, his lying, his workarounds, even his tantrums. He's the only human character on the screen. So what if Democrats acted instead as if they believed in democracy, right? If they believed in the ability of American citizens to understand issues and make informed choices? What if the left stated what they believe in policy-wise and then see if democracy can work? I get it. A lot's at stake. And many Democrats believe that if they don't win at least one chamber of Congress this election, that the electoral process could be rigged forever toward the current majority party. But real democracy demands an informed electorate. The Democrats will always lose in an unprincipled brawl. You know, the right can argue that unbridled, no-holds-barred competition is the basis of their whole economic and geopolitical philosophy, but Democrats don't have this option. Besides, if the left undermine the fundamental premise of democracy in order to win elections, what's left? know, if I could go back to that swanky restaurant with the former Secretary of State, I'd say no. I'm not ready to accept that the experiment of democracy has proven a failure. Not yet, anyway. This midterm, we have a chance to remember what it is we're doing this for, what this is really about, what's our role in this process, and whether or not we're up to that challenge. Are we even willing to show up at the polls, much less understand the issues we're voting on? Our politicians and their propagandists have lost faith in our ability to vote purposefully. They truly believe the democratic experiment has failed. I think they're wrong. But the only way we can effectively defend ourselves against the folks on both sides who would underestimate our intelligence, our competence, our collective will, is to vote. You're on Team Human. Our guest today, Jason Schmidt, whose documentary, Paywall, The Business of Scholarship, is screening at universities across the country.
Universities are about educating humans, and there is literally no reason to keep information from people.
The scholarly publishing industry makes about a 35 to 40% profit margin. How is it okay for this whole industry to be making so much a profit margin when there really aren't any inputs that they have to pay for?
Student, I definitely hit a paywall.
I hate paywalls a lot. How do you feel?
I feel really pissed.
So Jason, let's start at the now and then go back. So you just came out with a movie.
I did.
That's called?
It's called Paywall, The Business of Scholarship.
Paywall, The Business of Scholarship, which we can see. I mean, I started watching it, and then you can see it kind of for free, and then all of a sudden it stops, this movie, and says that you got to pay to watch it.
You hit a paywall.
Yeah, but then you can just click the play button and you keep going.
You just keep playing. It's not actually, it's a fake paywall.
I know, but it reminded me of my whole life, and I remembered then the reason why I started teaching at NYU, at ITP. Was because I was working on a book and trying to do research, and I kept coming up against paywalls. So I figured if I could adjunct at NYU and make like $3,000 a semester, I would get like $10,000 worth of access to all of those library things, ProQuest and Document This and JSTOR and those things.
And Science Direct and all these great services.
And it did seem to me like the Enlightenment ideal of like Al Gore when he was first describing the internet as this place to connect the world's information and we all get access. And I had Gopher searches and FTP searches and I could download weird documents from University of Tel Aviv. That was gone. It got closed. The commons got privatized. Was it always that way or did something happen?
I think it was something that happened. I mean, I think that scholarship started out as a way to disseminate knowledge to human kind of, the human species. And then in the interim from, 1665, when research journals came out, I mean, they were meant to really diffuse scholarship. And, down the road, and that's actually kind of in a more short scope, we've got it, the academic structures have been sort of duped into these contracts, and specifically what's called big deal formats, where you buy all these journals now in like a cable subscription means. And that was very different than what the 1665 or even the 1985 model of scholarship was. When you bought it, still universities purchased it. The costs weren't nearly what they are today in, let's say, 1985. When you purchased it, you owned it for perpetuity. And that was a very different model.
But they owned a thing, right? A journal was an object.
It was an object. It was a pressed object.
Right. And they would stick them on shelves in these, sometimes they would bind them together into like their years. And sometimes they'd stick them in these like leather foldery thing. So it'd be like four copies of the Journal of International blah blah.
Right.
You'd go to a library to find it, to read your article.
Yep. Talk to a reference librarian, get your directions to that article.
And you would either Xerox it in the library or read it in there. Maybe if you were special, you took it home. But usually those things
Yeah.
Stayed
in the library often. I remember spending, you know, hours in front of that Xerox machine, copying. Yeah, of course.
Right. But at least you could get your hands on the thing.
And in a capacity, you sort of owned it then. You had a tangible copy that couldn't be taken away from you unless you had a house fire.
Right. And was it against the rules to take Journal X in the library and put a dime in the machine and copy out?
No, I was at University of Michigan, and specifically I remember there was a lot of kind of copyright gray area. And so they would have us go across the street from the university in our graduate course, and we'd have these, you know, literally like 500 page, you know, reading supplements. We'd take them, put them on the Xerox machine ourselves, and we would have to go there with somebody helping us, and it would be our finger that would hit print, and it would go through the print process, and that was kind of a loophole for those copyright, protections for that.
But then we were kind of breaking a rule, though.
Oh, but who? We're not getting paid. We're breaking a rule for companies. We're not breaking a rule for academics. Academics, I think, and if I can speak so liberally, I don't think actually have a problem with the sharing of knowledge, because we're never compensated in any way, shape, or form in the process of creating. We create this information as a, you know, as a service to our discipline. We edit this information as an editor for our journals to make sure it's quality, again, as a service. From an academic scope, it doesn't really become a financial means. It becomes financial in a different, you know, different capacity as it goes to publishers or scholarly societies.
Right. But so, I mean, publishing, there's a whole bunch of reasons to do it, but in academic publishing, a lot of it is like new professors or assistant professors. They need to get like 5 or 10 journal articles published in order to apply for tenure.
That's right.
Or something else.
And tenure hasn't changed in 150
right.
years.
So they have that. And then, so these companies, journal company, Elsevier, or whatever they sure. are,
yep.
they're doing a service by organizing a peer-reviewed journal for the advancement of your career.
They're absolutely doing a service, and they're providing, you know, some of the highest quality journals that are some of the most respected journals, Nature or Science or Cell or some of these, you know, really high, what they call impact factor.
Right.
And impact factor is something we should talk about down the road as well. It's, you know, a quantitative measure that, you know, really kind of, you know, talks about the scope and the breadth of that journal. There's a lot of faults with that, and I think that's, you know, something that the whole world is kind of focused on, is this impact factor, quantitative nature of these journals, and making sure if you publish in that high impact journal, your success for the tenure plea is much more likely to be heard.
Right, because if that's the product, that's, right, and we can go to that. If the yep. product for now is the attention and metrics I need to win tenure or an advancement, then I want to be at a journal that's in the whole digital sphere in such a way that a lot of people are going to see it and footnote it, because the more references I get, it's like getting likes on Facebook. So
that's
academics
right.
have
exactly.
this many references to your article, and then you can say, oh, I had 79 references. And then that's a more important article, and then I get more love for my provost.
You get more love, but you don't actually know that the impact factor is talking about your article specifically. You could be next to a great, you know, great article on stem cell that's getting tons of traction,
yeah.
and you're not the cool kid, and yours is just always flipped over, but you're still getting that prestige because you somehow snuck into that, you know, that high brand identity, you know, cover to cover
right.
journal.
But you're saying now that in the old days,
yes.
these journals got something, you know, so they would sell a subscription to the library for $400 a year or
mm-hmm.
whatever it is. And if they're an important enough journal,
sure.
then enough libraries get it. And they're making some money. And the money they make on the high impact journal, maybe it even subsidizes some of the low impact ones that don't have enough sales, you know, the journal of, you know, raisin technology.
Absolutely.
You know, where there's not yep. that many people studying raisins.
Yes.
So, and God bless. So now they're being subsidized or they're break even. And then when the internet came around, we first all thought, oh, this means those journals are all going to die.
1995, Forbes magazine wrote an article saying the internet revolution was going to change the tide.
Right.
And the first thing it was going to affect, it wasn't going to affect music or movie studios. Those were solid. And this 1995 article said the first thing that would be the icon to fall would be scholarly publishing, because researchers are so progressive and, you know, have went on the internet for, you know, for decades at that
right.
point. Telnet in the 80s and 90s, you know, ARPNet, and using using this as a form of communicating, that surely this internet revolution is going to lower the cost margins and really kind of push right. out the publishers. And the exact opposite actually had happened. You know, from 95 on, if you look at the scope of, that's where the problem started, is once it became digital, the profits went, you know, through the roof. We're at a profit margin of 30 to 40% for for-profit publishers. That's more than Facebook, more than Google.
But why should that be? I mean, so if now most people, if you have an internet connection and a public library card at this point, most public libraries have access to all those journals, don't they?
No, they do not. Not in the United States. Not at all. No, that's the other kind of big conundrum here. And I feel so bad as a professor. My students who are, you know, running in four different directions at once, trying to get a degree and trying to figure out what they're going to do with their life. They have access to everything, but it's at the wrong time of their career, right? They're 18, they're 19, they're 21,
well, that's
22.
That's why the companies don't mind giving it to them.
Yeah, well, but when they're 25 and 26 and thinking, hey, I want to do this startup company. I want to really understand, you know, biogenetic research.
Right.
Good luck if you're not a grad student in the United States. Good luck getting access to that. There is a very, you know, clear and defined access point of access, and that's really in my film pretty prominently.
Yeah.
Is talking about, you know, and these librarians have to turn away the public for publicly funded research, which is really counterintuitive to what a librarian has devoted her or his career to, and that's problematic for us as a society, mainly for synergy. Doug, right. I want synergy. I want 1 + 1 + 1 to equal 8. And the only way to do that is to have diverse people and diverse perspectives. And I think the way that we're operating in a scholarly kind of society with these profits and who can afford to have access, it's the opposite. It's a homogenized. 40% of what's published in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the top journals,
anywhere.
Presumably,
yeah.
40% is published within 150 miles of Boston. So what does that say? I mean, so...
Well, that's what they call it, New England, right?
Yeah, well, talk about privileged.
But if you're over near Denver, is there a Midwestern Journal of Medicine?
I'm not talking about Denver. I'm talking about Nepal. I'm talking about, you know, Brazil. I want the right. globe to have... And I'm talking about, you know, Zika and Ebola and, you know, these major things for, you know, for humanity to overcome. And we're not allowing... our engines to fire on all 8 cylinders, Detroit metaphor from my genetics. You know, we're firing on 4 or 5 cylinders because not everybody has access because of the costs, because of the profit margins.
So if you're going to open it, I mean, so this was Aaron's
Aaron
dream,
Schwartz.
Right? Aaron Schwartz.
Yep.
Now, he was an activist as well as
a
thinker. So yes. What he did was an open access experiment, really, as a public statement.
As an MIT student, he downloaded the JSTOR catalog and, you know, got caught doing so and had some serious repercussions between both MIT and JSTOR and pushed him to the brink of, you know, human capacity. And that was some idea that's, I mean, it shows the power behind this. You know, you think, you know, we're talking about academic scholarship. It doesn't sound like the most, you know, like, you know, dark kind of foggy kind of transaction, but there's been a lot of people that have had to put everything on the line for this because there is so much backlash and there's so much power and there's so much kind of, you know, disinfecting the trail. So as a journalist, I started writing about open access well before I did as a filmmaker. And I would, you know, first of all, the articles I wrote on open access, they got massive reads, you know, 400,000 or 500,000 people
right.
around the globe wanting to, again, amplify and diffuse this off of Twitter and Facebook. And, you know, and I thought, well, how profound this is, like, you know, a whole like community is like starved for access. So then I started speaking out more and more about this. And the more I'd speak to other journalists, it happened like 4 times this process. Uh-huh. I'd speak about the need for open access and specifically the profit margins, $25.2 billion a year going into for-profit publishers, Elsevier having a 35 to 40% profit margin. And what happens every time was then that I would be contacted by a PR representative by one of these for-profit companies, you know, saying, what are you doing? This is just completely, you know, this isn't true. And they'd contact that journalist and try to, you know, put
right.
across their statistics. The journalist then would contact me and say, you know, do you stand behind what you said? And every time I say, yeah, no, I'm clear with what I said and I stand behind that. And but that show, gosh, there's not only so much energy in it, but there's kind of like a disinfecting, like the trail behind it as well,
right.
wanting to get that whole message in with no kind of backlash there. And so seeing that, again, as kind of an investigative journalist or filmmaker, you're thinking, okay, what's going on in this equation then that, you know, you have this much kind of funding to make sure it's almost like a full Disneyland experience. And so that's, you know, kind of where I wanted to go as a filmmaker and kind of unpack this. And so, you know, my crew and I traveled 45,000 miles for the last year and a half. We had a super small grant, but I have five great media savvy animation and kind of film students that helped me on a shoestring budget. And we were able to piece together what I think is, you know, kind of, if nothing else, it's a, it gives a story and kind of a face to the movement. Open access is such a disparate, and that's what this is all about, is open access to scholarship and open access to information. And it's such a disparate community, and there's so many different methods, and there's green open access and gold open access and diamond and platinum. I mean, it sounds more like Tiffany's than it sounds like, you know, I'm like, I'm so confused just, you know, hearing all those if I'm, you know, a new scholar. So I wanted to make kind of, you know, a narrative that talks about this whole movement. And so that's that. I mean, that's what we've been doing, and you know, we're pretty proud of the reception so far. So we've, you know, we have 75,000 people have viewed the film. We have 320 screenings at universities around the world now, and it's kind of, you know, taking on a life of its own. And you hope you can you do that. You never know. You know better than anybody. You're sitting in an office editing. I'm sitting there editing in, you know, quiet solitude for months and months, thinking, is this thing at all any good? I don't know if it is, and nobody's saying they like it. And then all of a sudden, it starts to, you know, create that snowball effect. And you're like, okay, damn, I'm happy I did this now.
Yeah, I mean, well, you were able to do two things. One, you found moments somehow in a nonfiction medium, and then you connect things. I mean, the part that's most interesting to me is the moments in the movie where this seemingly random system coalesces. Sure. So for you, I mean, what were some of the biggest moments of discovery for you as you were making this thing?
Biggest moments of discovery for me as I'm making this? Well, you know, going to the Royal Society, which is really the foundation, holy grail for research journals.
To better understand the research process, we traveled to where research journals originated, the Royal Society of London.
I'm Stuart Taylor. I'm the publishing director here at the Royal Society. The Royal Society is Britain's National Academy of Science. It was founded in 1660. A few years after that, in 1665, Henry Oldenburg launched the world's first science journal called Philosophical Transactions. And that was the first time that the scientific achievements and discoveries of early scientists was formally recorded.
Flipping through the 1665 Philosophical Transactions, literally the first research journal on planet Earth, and having three different copies and going through them and seeing what that represented, and seeing how that's the Royal Society, you know, which is still extremely prominent, is dying, is really massively pushing towards open access. And, you know, it's not happy with where it's getting. It's not happy with the movement that's behind it. And, you know, it's really supportive of this project.
And going, this is the RSA that's still there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, they have an open access office, and they're.
Did you do? Did you show the movie there?
I have not shown the movie there yet.
It seems they do a lunch.
Yeah,
events there.
We're showing the British Library, which is one of my favorite. My favorite library on planet Earth. We're going to be there January 30th for a screening. So hopefully Royal Society can come there, and they've been nothing but supporters. But so, you know, hearing the support for, you know, open access, and talking to like the executive director of African Libraries, and hearing how, you know, Elsevier, which is the, you know, biggest publisher, is nothing but a pain in the neck, to use her words.
Oh my goodness. yes, Elsevier is a pain in the neck for us in Africa, because their prices are too high for us. They don't want to come down.
You know, this isn't just about economics. This is about empowering, you know, countries and regions to the equation.
Right.
So I mean that is.
I mean, you could look at it like patented drugs or anything else.
Yeah.
So you're going to die because you don't have the money to, you know, pay for the patented medication, which only costs 6 cents to make. But
so,
you know, but there's funding. I mean, part of the reason to fund something is so that some, you know, evil dude can sit in his mansion on the top of a hill. But part of the reason for funding is so that the research and publications can happen in the first place.
We have a person in our film, John Willibanks. He's a Sage Bio Networks open activist, and he's talking about the lackup of research and how that is inhibiting the understanding of what drugs we as a human species should take. Because, you know, if you're a biomed startup, you don't have access to all of the, to do text mining and data analysis.
Right.
You don't have access to that. So his big moment in our film is he's saying there's more companies pursuing automated cars.
And there are more companies competing to make self-driving cars than there are to process the biomedical literature and help us decide what drug to take. And that is a direct consequence of the lockup of the literature. That's a fundamental fucking problem.
Yeah, I love that I have the word fucking in my film, because I feel like, you know, it's a kind of a climax for the storyline.
Yeah.
But I mean, it really shows the kind of, you know, rage that's associated with this and how it's really inhibiting the broad access to research that can help cure diseases that we have at the front of our minds as a species.
But it's part of a societal trend. I mean, that you can trace back to capitalism and the monarchy.
Yes.
You know, so you know, as Buckminster Fuller would tell the story, there were these great pirates out there who knew how to navigate. They knew different languages. They knew how to do economic transactions and currency exchange.
Yeah.
They could fight. And the kings were threatened by someone who had all of these disciplines under their in their tool set. So part of the reason for setting up universities with very separated disciplines was to prevent there from being a generalist who knew everything.
Interesting.
And likewise with capitalism, I mean, if you don't separate out the thing, you can't charge for it. I mean, you need to make your information scarce, or how are you going to make money off it? So if we're trying to use capitalism to, say, cure cancer, it's going to be really tricky, because now everybody's competing with closed source research to find their own cure to make money off, rather than collaborating together to actually solve the problem.
But it's that collaborating together, I think, that academics and the research community does so well. And again, it does so on a different time frame than capitalism. I mean, we're creating this research for free. We're using public funds to create this research. We're not, you know, the research community is not being compensated for the actual act of the research or the editing. So there's, I mean, the equation here, I feel like, is different than a lot of capitalistic entities.
You would think.
Well, that's why we're saying that this is off the chart profitable, because there's no inputs.
Yeah,
I want to be a business that has no inputs. I'm selling air. That's my new job.
Yeah, but it's not just off the charts profitable for the companies that would exploit these biases, but it has either risen from or informed an academic culture in America of competitiveness and pettiness and turf battles. I mean, you go all the way back to, you know, DNA, Watson and Crick.
Yeah.
I mean, they stole the thing from a woman downstairs, you know?
Sure.
So if the leading scientists are already stealing and claiming research, then why wouldn't the journals that serve them reflect the values of their culture?
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
I mean, so it's not like academics, oh, we're all so good.
No, oh, you know? No, absolutely
and,
not.
And look at these mean Elseviers exploiting
sure.
us.
No, absolutely. And this whole movement, I mean, there's so many kind of counterintuitive fights among these activist organizations for open access, and these scholars. I mean, it's not a congruent message by any means.
Right.
And so without collective action, especially, I feel like half of my kind of recent film tour has been kind of, I apologize for the United States of America regularly. You know, because we have very little action we can take. We have all these independent consortia that select the journals, and every single university or a good portion of them have embargoes that they can't tell what they're paying for the research journal. So it really creates a, you know, massively unfair market that you can't even compare a shop. So I asked Rutgers University. I said, could you tell, you know, me in the film what you pay for your subscriptions?
Could a university like Rutgers tell somebody what they pay for?
No, we wouldn't, no.
Because you're contractually bound not to.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the way it works. So again, it's not up to me to comment on that particular aspect, but it is the way it works. And it's the way it works with all publishers, not just the ones you hear about.
You know, and no, none of these universities can.
Because they each think they're getting some special deal or whatever.
Maybe for the first year or two, it seems like a darn good deal. You know, you sign that clause that you're not going to be able to share that information. But then, you know, a decade or two, you're not aware of what your your other universities are paying. And
well, a public university has to say what they're spending.
It's still a tricky yeah. kind of process to figure it out. There's been a couple of Freedom of Information Acts that have worked well. One was done over in the UK in 2014. There was a Freedom of Information Act done in California in 2007 and 8. But they're few and far between to really understand what the full scope is that all these universities are paying.
I mean, the fun part at the beginning of the film is when you are asking everybody if they ever came up against a firewall.
Yeah, paywall.
A paywall.
Yeah.
Yeah, paywall. Yeah, firewall's a whole other thing.
Hey, yeah.
But it was funny because then I started to think about Medium's new model.
Sure.
So, you know, and I've been doing a column on there. And Medium's model is they want to create an ad-free kind of a writing commons mm-hmm. is the way they look at it. So everybody throws $5 into the pot per month to be like a member of this thing or a reader of this thing. And you can write also. And then whatever pieces get the most views and claps and approvals and comments and whatever get a percentage of the common pie.
Yeah.
But it still has a paywall. I mean, so you can read three or four things for free. Mm-hmm. And then after that, if you want to be reading this stuff that's part of this commons, you gotta participate. And on a certain level, though, as someone who wants to make a living writing and who's willing to tough it out in the dog-eat-dog, you know, quest for views or whatever
sure,
it is,
yeah.
I'll go for it. I mean, other than a paywall of some kind, we end up being part of the attention economy. We end up being part of the advertising world, which is even worse, isn't
right.
it?
No, I agree with you. You know, that the advertising, you know, broad human bandwidth of our attention. I mean, that's not a healthy model as well. If all of our revenue is driven off of that, you know, attention bandwidth, that's tricky. You know, so, but I don't think that's a congruent conversation to the scholarship. I'm saying that
scholarship is different.
Scholarship is absolutely different. You know, first of all, again, I think it has a bit different input process. It has a different readership process, and it forms a different function. And there's, you know, all these massive philanthropies and funders that are, you know, funding this research as well. So there's different inputs that are going into the stream as opposed to, you know, somebody that just needs those likes or, you know,
right. I mean, but all the inputs are crazy and I feel terrible, but, you know, I'll get asked, oh, will you please write a chapter for such and such a book about, you know, the future of digital, blah, blah, blah. And it'll be, you know, oh, we want 8,000 words. We want you to do all this research and footnotes and stuff and 9 drafts with us. And we want to pay you nothing.
Right.
And it's like, wait a minute. Why?
They didn't even say the exposure. We're going to give you exposure. You know that they're because not going to get, you're not going to get any exposure.
No, and it's going to be
20 people are going to read it.
It's going to be a book that costs $140.
Right. Nobody's going to, yeah.
So no one's going to buy it. It's not going to be anybody's textbook. No kid is going to read it.
Nobody. No.
So what's going on? What is this for? And am I a bad person for not writing for free for them?
Everything I've done as an academic has been trying to merge broad impact with academic topics. And I feel like that's where my mentality is, can grasp what I do in the day in, day out in academics. So everything I'm doing with this project or all of my writing is trying to take these kind of academic, you know, kind of directions and bring it to a mass audience. And, I, you know, for who I am as an individual, I feel like that is, you know, kind of even grounds.
That's what I've been trying to do, too. I mean, so all my books are like, I guess Life Inc. was the first one that really did this, are kind of books that would be academic books, but then expressed in the plain language of a Neil Postman, you know, in order to try to popularize otherwise complicated ideas.
All right, so Douglas, I was on a plane and I was reading Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus,
yes.
And the person next to me on the plane was giving me a really strange look as I was reading your chapter, and I thought, what am I doing? And I look, and the heading of the chapter is eliminating humans from the equation as I'm on an airplane. Uh-huh. And she wasn't liking your chapter title because it seemed like it might have a different implication for
like
air travel.
It was
it looked like it might have been terrorism directed.
Well, they are removing humans from the equation in air travel. I mean, not just through terror, but you know, the automatic landings and things. And,
sure.
You know, so it's really going to get to the point where when a pilot has to land the plane, it's like, oh shit. Oh. I haven't done this in 40 years.
That's funny. Yeah.
Yeah. But again, but that was, I mean, meant as a how do you popularize?
Yeah.
And it's because the, see, I don't know whether it's that I overestimate, but I feel like academia underestimates the intelligence of people.
Yeah.
Of real people. But, and then they write in these ways. I mean, have you read these journals?
Oh, I know.
I mean, why do they write like that? You know, it's almost intentionally obscuring, as if to hide the fact that these are simple ideas.
Neil deGrasse Tyson just had a great piece in the Chronicle here about 3 weeks ago, where he's talking about his dual hat career. I mean, he's doing incredible, you know, research as a scholar, but he's also, you know, really taking these, you know, pretty complex notions and taking them to a broad society, and he doing it kind of on a scope that everybody can understand,
right.
And a, you know, kind of, you know, just a very friendly
math. Astrophysics and for busy people.
Absolutely. And he says, you know, that worked really well for his career. And, you know, that's kind of maybe the dual hats that many of these, you know, researchers need to have. And then there's, you know, others that say, well, come on, that's you know, watering down what we do in the scholarship. We shouldn't be our own public. That was another piece recently came out. You know, why should academics be their own publicists? That's not what this is about. And I'm caught in this kind of quandary between these two. I mean, I understand that, you know, what we do is, you know, research specific and shouldn't be all about publicity. But then the other side is, if you actually want to have impact on what you do, you know, you gotta get it out there for actual eyeballs and to motivate and to, you know, help to inform a broader society.
Yeah, but I mean, there's nothing your doctor hates worse, or there's nothing your oncologist hates worse than someone who actually has access to those articles. I mean, you know, people in my family have various diseases, and I go online and try to find out what they are. Yep. And then, again, you hit the paywall on the article that actually has the study that can say whether or not fish oil is going to help, you know, something or other.
And you were able to read one or two paragraphs, and you don't know.
And you can't really tell.
Is it worth that $40 to, you know, to read this? And then, you know, you pay it, and then it's you know, totally off base of where you thought it was going to go. And so,
And the abstract has become a sales document.
Sure it is. Absolutely. I'm even more concerned that doctors themselves don't have access to the current research, right? And so that's something that, again,
that's paying the fee. And
well,
getting...
and this is part of, you know, kind of my film too, talking to Nepal-based, you know, medical doctor. Does he have access to the current research? No. Can he get access to the current research without paying? No. You know, is he able to contribute like his West?
Between are his people going to get antibiotics or is he going to get access?
Access to read. Really? You know, that's what we're operating. This is the human species we've decided is the best method forward for the planet.
Apparently.
Yeah. No, nobody is. And that's what, I mean, that's why these, you know, A, that's why I think these topics get so much traction. B, I think is I was really concerned I was going to get sued early on in this project because, you know, there's kind of a lot of pushback that I was getting for-profit as publishers. This was getting close to launching. And I was really very concerned, some sleepless nights there. But as this product has, you know, diffused out, and now there's a lot of minnows that are swimming in my school with me, I feel like I have protection by the masses. Now that I have, you know, 300 and some universities and United Nations we were at yesterday, I feel like now almost I have protection because you don't want the publicity backlash of suing this little person, Jason Schmidt, as, you know, Elsevier or some other large entity.
Well, I mean, a lot of what you're looking at too is the collapse of the public sphere.
Yeah.
But I mean, in the end, the argument and some of these JSTOR people, one of the online things, they live right in my town. I'm one of the lawyers. They argue, well, yeah, but how are the journals going to get paid for? That they're going to go, that they're in trouble. They could go out of business.
Why do journals have to be expensive? Why do journals have to employ publicists and graphic designers and, you know, consultants and coordinators when the real imprimatur, the function of that journal is a a metric of the scholars that actually partake in the process.
Right, that so, everybody involved in the journal, I mean, and I'm on like two of them,
yeah.
where you basically read two or three articles a quarter and decide, you know, if they're suitable for publication or if they need to be changed. And I imagine in a real field, I mean,
yeah.
as opposed to my sort of liberal artsy stuff, it's not just based on opinion,
yes.
you know, but there's like science, like, oh no, birds don't fly like that. They fly like this.
Let's talk about linguistics.
Right.
There is a journal called Lingua. Lingua was a longstanding Elsevier journal for 60 some years at least. And the editorial body, there was five executive editors and there was 35 broader scope editors under them. They all met in kind of quiet conversation and said, hey, let's go ahead and flip this away from the for-profit journal model and make this an open access model. If we all do it together, we'll have the same credibility because we're the credibility. It's not
right.
Elsevier that bestows the credibility.
Right.
It's all of us. It's the commingling of these uh-huh. minds. If we all flip to a open access equivalent, we bring that credibility instantly with us. So they flipped
right.
in, about a year and a half ago from Lingua to Glossa. And the new journal that they created, Glossa, has had incredible impact. It's, you know, the stats are very parallel with what the old Elsevier stats mm-hmm. were.
I mean, it's a lot easier for me to justify working for free if everybody else in the room
yeah.
is working for free.
Exactly.
I hate when I go and like I get invited to something and I realize, oh my gosh, I'm the only one in this room who's not getting paid.
That's right. Exactly.
So that you could still, the group can still hire, you know, printers and secretary, administrative staff and all that. But that's like the university dream of like, wow, what if a university were run by the faculty and the administration was sort of the people that we hire to help
yeah, sure.
administrate our scholarship and teaching. But it kind of reversed now. It's like we work for the administration.
Oh, completely.
So now we sound Trumpian, don't we? It's those
a little
bureaucrats.
Bit. It's a little Paul Ginsberg, archive. You know, we haven't talked about him. And we also haven't talked about Alexander Elbakian and
okay.
Sci-Hub. But those, I think, both actually need to be unpacked.
All right.
Paul Ginsberg in the early 90s thought, hey, you know, we can really connect the physics and mathematics and computer science, and we can create this repository that we all deposit our papers in, so we always all have access to this.
Mm-hmm.
And that has fundamentally shaped those fields over the long haul.
And
because,
what was his original, what was, explain who he originally is.
He's a professor at Cornell University, physics professor, and he's been pivotal in creating this open access repository called archive.org, which houses all of these scholarly research papers.
And is funded by Brewster Kahle.
Is funded by Brewster yeah. Kahle, who's helped us with Internet Archive. So as this film came out, we had Dropbox Pro, and because we were getting so many global downloads trying to download the film, mm-hmm. we kept getting shut down from Dropbox. So Internet Archive came to our call and put both the smaller version as well as the 80 gig, like uncompressed for larger screen format version on Internet Archive, so we no longer had, you know,
right,
had that problem.
That streaming, yeah.
Yeah, the multi-billion-dollar startup Dropbox, they couldn't support us, and so yeah, luckily a nonprofit came our way, and in a matter of minutes, we were, you know, successfully supported. So I back to the Paul Ginsberg, I feel like archive.org has played a really, you know, pivotal role in creating a pilot for what a successful discipline or disciplines can do to create an open access community that can empower that broader discipline reach. I feel like there's something there that we can learn from.
So you're talking about what sounds like what was the internet was supposed to be anyway.
Well, that's
so it's like, can we create
that's
a safe
when it came
place?
Out, 91, you know, it's like, yeah, it was the early internet.
But can we create a safe place on the internet to do the internet?
Yeah, well, that's I'm sure when Forbes said that the scholarship was going to be the first domino to fall, they were looking at archive as the model of, well, clearly if archive can do this, we can, you know, all these other disciplines are going to follow suit.
Well, and the reason why scholarship should have been the first one to fall is because scholarship's the one thing that we are doing intentionally for free.
Absolutely. I think that's the best sentence we've said this whole thing. I think, you know, that's great. And so people, you've said Aaron Schwartz twice up to this point, but people are willing to put their life on the line and stand out for causes. And, you know, there's been a lot of people that have really stood up strong. And I think one person that deserves more awards and more Time Person of the Year kind of nominations is Alexandra Elbakian with Sci-Hub. What she stood out for and created, Sci-Hub, which is a torrent to download any academic paper, quote-unquote illegally, not that the scholars usually think of it themselves as that. She has 65 million articles, research papers on her site now. And if you look at the actual usage rates, you know, it's being used all over the globe, but specifically if we're talking kind of in this New England area that we're at right now, you know, SciHub's being used tremendously within Cambridge. The most privileged people of our society are thinking, you know what? It's such a cumbersome process. The user experience of accessing this and logging in and authenticating and being home and not and having to do a different authentication process. It's so cumbersome that, you know what? I'm just going to go ahead and illegally torrent that even though I'm part of Harvard, because it's just easier to go onto her site and within two clicks, get the article. It's sent directly to me and be done with it.
But why isn't she in jail?
She's in hiding in Russia, and she's been served with multiple injunctions from Elsevier, many millions of dollars, and she's staying true to her cause.
And because it's Tor, they can't shut it down.
That's right. Well, it just always pops right back up. And, you know, if you go to a site that's SciHub and it's not there, go ahead and, you know, put in Twitter current site and it'll, you know, there'll be a new link of a new URL and it continues to live on and it's healthier than ever in many ways.
So it's like a pirate bay of knowledge.
It's a pirate bay of knowledge. And it's empowering my Nepal-based colleagues. It's empowering my Global South colleagues that, you know, they're the loss in this conversation. They're the ones that are paying the biggest bill. We're talking about the repercussions from cushy offices. I want to empower those without access instantly. I'm not going to say, well, let's do this incremental for them. You know, that and that's kind of that's always the academic scope. But let's do incremental. We're going to roll out open access incrementally. 2002, open access really started as a fundamental movement. The Budapest Open, they did a Budapest conference on open access in 2002. We're 16 years later, and nothing has that tremendously changed. So we need something a little bit more top-down approach. I think that's what Robert Jan Smits within Europe and his Plan S is doing, is saying, okay, you know, by 2020, a year from now practically, we're going to have open access be the mandate, and anything that's funded is going to have to go through and be open.
I mean, it goes back, though, to trying to make education profitable. You know, it's the No Child Left Behind was really for George W. and his friends in Texas to, you know, monopolize textbook sales in the U.S. And when you go back and say, well, wait a minute, what is even I mean, there's two different things here. There's the research part of it, which is heinous, so that scientists and medical researchers, psychologists can't get access to expensive American research results because there's a few for-profit media companies that want to extract value out of this thing.
And make it as scarce can be.
Right. That it's already a commons being enclosed.
That's right.
You know, so the commons is still operating from within this giant for-profit enclosure that it's been put inside.
Yes.
So there's that.
Yep.
But then that also, it corresponds to a shift in education from, even when I heard you talking about the liberal arts school that you're at and these kids graduate,
not able to get
jobs. And I'm thinking, since when was the point of liberal arts education to get people jobs?
Sure.
Education, well, certainly public education, was meant as compensation for a life spent working in the mine, that you can come home from work and read a novel and understand it, participate in democracy as an informed citizen.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a way for corporations to externalize their training programs to the university.
I know.
I'm such a purist.
No, you're so good. But like I'm thinking about the whole the state kind of the land grant initiative. I mean, that's, you know, when the land grant initiative came out, I mean, talk about empowering. You have, you know, multi-million dollar parcels that could either be used or sold to empower higher education that had a economic model that could just be, you know, pursuit of knowledge for the sake of pursuit of knowledge, and the economy at that time I think was, you know, much more robust.
I mean, I love the idea. I mean, in a certain way, if the Pirate Bay of journal articles, if it really does disrupt the journal industry to the point where Elsevier and Thomson Reuters and all these people, whoever does them, says, screw it, we're gonna leave the academic journal industry because it stinks, then We don't even have to convince people to leave to go to the open access. It'll just become an open access thing. But what's your projection? How is this gonna play out, do you think?
The publishers are already divesting away from journals. They know the writing's on the wall. They know that they're gonna drag their feet on this, and it's, you know, they're gonna drag their feet as long as they possibly can, which is exactly what I experienced in the record label industry. Same thing that the large labels did when, you know, Napster was kind of taking a large swath of the economy. But they're divesting in storytelling narrative for the university, and they're going specifically in the data analysis and how to tell the data of universities, and they're going to the provosts and presidents to tell the impact of that whole university and where everybody's scholarship is going, and
help universities compete in the U.S. News and World Report
thing, and how to hack the
models.
Hack the model, get up there on yep. You want to be a top 20 university? We can do that. We'll make sure we can, you know, be able to tell. You're not going to have anybody go through the cracks. We have the best software available to understand where everybody's publications are going.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think they're already, you know, massively divesting into those other areas of, you know, around the higher education system. But it's not going to be without a major turbulence of, you know, they're not going to just kind of relinquish, these rights on these, you know, high impact journals.
Right.
It's going to be, you know, it's going to be kind of a tenacious kind of, you know, rollout.
I mean, from the Team Human perspective, I mean, what you're asking for is really that we retrieve the basic human instinct for sharing, you know, mimesis and sharing. And, oh, I figured out if you bang on the coconut with this kind of rock, it's going to open up, and then you get all the stuff inside,
and
you're going to show it to everybody.
Right. And everybody in your village teaches each other.
Right.
And how nice is that? I mean, right. So, I mean,
and
I think
it's
your
almost
whole...
like we're trying to repress that instinct and replace it with some false sense of, you know, pride or individual achievement. I'm the guy. You can break the, as long as you remember, give me a penny every time you break a coconut with a rock like that.
Yeah.
It's like, how would we have ever developed language? It's like, okay, the word the... I made that one. So I get a penny every time someone uses the, and you get a nickel when they use a.
This is true. No, it's the human conversation, I think, is the driving force I think the foundations and the larger funders are seeing, you know, open as a way to really impact the broader society and to get the synergistic kind of opportunities for the research they're already supporting. You know, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has a really strong open access push here in the United States, and they know that their funder, the scientists that are conducting the research for them are going to publish in open access outlets, and that's helping to synergize those conversations. So from the U.S. angle, you know, the funders can really play a pivotal process in the rollout of open access, because I feel like that's one of the better levers that we have in a capitalistic kind of U.S.
Right.
sort of system. Makes sense. The funders, who holds the money for these grants? Yeah, that's where it's sure as heck isn't these consortia of libraries and these independent universities. They're not going to come together in a cohesive manner. They can't.
In competition.
Absolutely, and they've already signed all these embargoes in this content. So it has to be on the U.S. side, you know, funders that are going to play out a big portion in that rollout.
Yeah, and luckily, a lot of this doesn't need funding. You know, the research is all happening
for
free or yep. by different funding.
That's
you
true.
Know, the
many people say there's enough money in the system right now. It's not that we need to find more money. We just have to redistribute how it's in the system.
Right. I mean, wouldn't it be fun? Even, you know, I write sometimes for this thing called the EAM, the Explorations in Media Ecology. It's the, you know, media ecology,
media ecology.
Little journal
yeah, you're right,
stuff.
Yeah.
But it's like nobody has it. It's not in print or anything. So I just, people have been asking on one of those academos kind of things. They've been asking for this paper I wrote in it. So I went and I scanned the damn thing uploaded it to, I mean, I guess that's against the rules, but geez, I wrote the thing and no one can get it. No one can click on it.
Yeah. We interviewed the assistant professor at Harvard who was at Princeton, and when he was there, he got takedown notices for two of his Elsevier research papers that were up on Princeton's website as PDFs. And he thought, gosh, you know, there's literally thousands of PDFs of Elsevier papers on Princeton's site. Why did they just target him and one other colleague? And in our film, he says, well, he thinks that they were just testing the waters. They could easily. There's nothing that's preventing Elsevier from doing a massive web crawl,
right,
figuring out every single paper that's, you know, used against the copyright and issuing massive takedown notices.
Right.
But they don't do it because they don't want to anger the source of free labor that they so depend on for this whole process and ecosystem to work out. So he thinks they were just kind of testing the waters to see what would happen if, you know, just send takedown notices for two people, see what Princeton does. And so Princeton kind of, I think, wisely pushed back and said no. And so after a little bit of a tug of war between legal departments, Elsevier retracted that takedown notice and Princeton protected his ability to have that PDF up. And, you know, so but I feel like there's, again, this isn't a normal, like, you know, kind of war because, you know, they can't anger the source of free labor that they depend on too much. You know, it's not
right.
Two competing sources that you can just go out and punch the other person because then they no longer want to help you. So it's this really kind of, you know, it's you know, an opaque system.
Right. I mean, and that's always, and the opacity then protects the system.
This is true. Yeah, completely.
Keep the secrets.
I feel like there's
the way you prevent solidarity and everything else between everybody.
Yep. And there's very few markets, I think, that can keep kind of the opacity the way it is, more so than higher education. Everybody's focused on their one pursuit. They're not usually a communicative mindset. If you have a communicative mindset, you're more of an administration. You're not usually on the front lines of the research. And it, you know, creates more disparity and you know, difference of opinions and less collective action. And I think that's something that as society, we need to stand out on.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I get a lot of people pervert, you know, Stuart Brand, and they just use the first half of his information wants to be free,
yeah,
and they lose the information wants to be protected. But I think you're arguing that information may want to be protected, but it doesn't want to be protected through by being cloistered. It wants to be protected by a community of peers who are, you know, evaluating and helping the rest of us understand whether there's merit or not in it.
I think that's absolutely the correct method. And we live in a society now that we have, you know, we can share this scholarship for no extra additional cost. I mean, the ability to, you know, create and research and actually, you know, format the piece of research initially, there's cost there. But once that's done, there's no extra marginal cost to disseminate that to a world audience.
Right. And it's not like the journal was ever paying for that research to begin with anyway.
Absolutely. No, it's research.
It's just a system that's gotten out of control.
The tenure system, the academic research system, I think is in fundamental needs of a revamp. And I think scholars are, you know, inadequate to often do that themselves, if the last 20 years has taught us anything.
So what's next for you?
Well, so we're traveling kind of a crazy amount. I've been to more university offices and more leaders of open access and scholars and editors. It's just been a really amazing opportunity just to, you know, to interact with so many people and both to talk about the dysfunction, but also to see a lot of the actual functionality and the brilliant people that are in academics and that are really doing this for the right causes. We didn't, you know, go into this because of the profit that we're able to induce ourselves. We went into this for the unencumbered, you know, investigation and, you know, ability for our minds to go where we want without having, you know, often other forces, you know, put on them. And so.
And it's great to hear you're not tilting at windmills, that there is a large community out there of people with skills and means who are promoting this open access.
There is a lot of people that are promoting this open access. It's rallying cries. I mean, everything's about, like, you know, universities are kind of the problem. They can't have a collective voice. But at the same point, I think they all understand that there's a problem. And, you know, United Nations bringing us in to talk. I mean, that's signaling there's a lot of people that understand that these inequalities are unjust.
Right. And that open access is ultimately a human rights issue.
It's absolutely a human rights issue.
Thank you for joining Team Human.
Oh, happy to be on Team Human.
Beautiful. And people can most easily watch this movie.
And people can most easily watch this movie by going to paywallthemovie.com. It's also on Vimeo. It's on Internet Archive. It's on YouTube. But paywallthemovie.com has all sorts of trailers and other, you know, little things as well on it.
Fun things and easy little shareable links.
Yes.
Thanks for listening to Team Human. Our guest today was Jason Schmidt. You can support Team Human and even get a copy of my upcoming book, Team Human, by subscribing to our show. Just go to teamhuman.fm and click on support. You can also read my columns based on the show's monologues at medium.com/@Rushkoff. We'll be back in the Basement Media Squad at the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at CUNY Queens next week with new strategies for intervention in the machine. You're on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.